good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe, titled How Will Capitalism End? Reflections on a Failing System. Our speaker is Wolfgang Strake, Director Emeritus at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Societies in Cologne. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Cornel Ban, Assistant Professor of International Relations and Co-Director of the Global Economic Governance Initiative at Boston University.
I have the honor to introduce the Professor Wolfgang Strake, and I will not start with his scholarship because he had a fascinating life as well, which doesn't happen nowadays, but if he's right, it's going to happen again. He's one of the children of refugees from Sudetenland, who's, according to one of his statements for The Guardian, who stole vegetables from the fields and coal from passing trains in order to survive. He went to a grammar school founded by Martin Luther, no less, was a student radical in 1968, but as he put it with a Pasolini-like style, he was closer to the working class than to the pot-smoking class. Professor Strake came of age in the intellectual miracle that was called the Frankfurt School, and in 1974 he became assistant professor in sociology at the University of Münster. In 1986 finished his habilitation in sociology at Bielefeld University, and then had a long transatlantic career, having taught sociology and industrial relations at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, from where he returned to Germany in 1995 to take up the post as director of the prestigious Max Planck Institute for the Study of Societies, and he taught sociology at the University of Cologne. He retired from his post in 2014, and since then he has been churning out life-changing books and articles for the rest of us. Strake is not only an ordinary scholar, and I'm not going to dwell on the fact that he has 36,000 citations. That's more than several universities combined in social science. That would be too productivist for his taste. But I would like to say that he's simply a critical juncture in how we understand empirically and theoretically capitalist diversity, where varieties of capitalism propose a static view of this diversity. He proposed a dialectic one that combines boots on the ground, empirical research, and the deepest of sociological and philosophical traditions. In addition to his pioneering work on democratic capitalism, known as the shotgun marriage between capitalism and democracy, he also authored many works on the rise of neoliberalism, the politics of austerity, and the political economy of Germany. Today, I think he's the very intellectual embodiment of a particular reaction to the demoralization of centrist politics, the return to a radical critique of capitalism. That's the reaction. What gives Strake's analysis unique firepower is that he comes from the very establishment he now critiques as the joint head of the Germany's top social science institute, advisor to the in the late 1980s to the labor unions, and part of a process that led surrounded the mainstreaming and the transformation in a neoliberal direction of Gerhard Schröder's SPD. But he was always a social democrat who never bought into the third way. So he was always on the left of that establishment. Most importantly, Strake is all about big ideas, big thinking, and about big issues, which is what the talk today here will bring to the fore. Many have sounded the alarms of the end of capitalism many times. This time it's different, Strake argues. Time cannot be bought anymore. His previous book was called Buying Time. This one is about how we're done. So expect a protracted period of putrefaction, punctured by fitful spasms at best. Neither revolution nor reform are possible. As he puts it, I spent a long time in my life exploring the possibilities for an intelligent social democratic solution of the class conflict. The idea that we could modify capitalism towards equality and social justice. That we could tame the beast. Now I think those are more or less utopian ideas. His lecture is about how this shotgun marriage between capitalism and democracy ends like in that classic Italian movie from the 1960s called Marriage Italian Style, where one of the partners is being shot. Wolfgang, you have the floor.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. This very nice reporter from The Guardian, he has written up my life, and it will stick with me forever. I will talk about this beautiful book. It is on capitalism, not necessarily on Europe. The book is a collection of essays, not by accident. It is not a grand theory. It is not something that is sort of systematically built. And the reason is that I think we still need to do some work to be able to do this. It is, however, an attempt to explain to my colleagues in the social sciences, in sociology and in political science, that today our disciplines can no longer be productive unless we work in a good part of political economy and unless we begin to understand how our subjects are related to what used to be called in the tradition of the Frankfurt School the totality of our societies, which is which includes the process of material reproduction in its modern form, and that is modern capitalism. So essentially the final chapter of the book is a plaidoyer for a social science that remembers its origins in the late 19th century and early 20th century, when there was no distinction between economics, political science, and sociology. Max Weber cannot be allocated to any of these disciplines, nor can Karl Marx, nor Werner Sombart. And in many ways, one would also say that someone like John Maynard Keynes was not just an economist. There were good reasons to see these not to departmentalize the world into the turfs of different of different disciplines, but look at the whole beast in its entirety. So, in this book, and in a couple of preceding essays, some of which are present here, I want to make it plausible why it is worthwhile again to think about the end of capitalism, about a crisis of capitalism that ends this regime. And of course this suggestion raises a number of questions that I will try to address in my following remarks. The end of capitalism, I see this in terms of a reconstruction of the laws of movement, that is the endogenous dynamics of this particular social configuration. What I insist on is that if that structure plays a very important part, and that what happens to capitalism is not just a matter of agency, what governments do, what we do, what how much energy we save or whatever, but it's also a question of structure, because there's something going on there that drives developments that we have to cope with. And coping with this dynamic is the important question. This endogeneity of change, the pressure that comes out of an institutionalized dynamic system, is something that needs to be considered in the context of Marxist sociology. And in many ways, in the 1960s, when in the United States the social sciences became tamed, so to speak, became domesticated after the war, the modernization theory tried to capture this question or this problem of a movement driven from within, so to speak, a historical dynamic. Then later we sort of dissociated ourselves from modernization theory, and in the course we dumped the baby with the bathwater. Yes, so history And that's my that's also something I will say. History is another very important sub-theme of this reasoning. My second point is to specify why it is legitimate to think about capitalism ending. Generally, as a very general point, capitalism is a historical social formation. It has a beginning, and the logic, if it has a beginning, it also has an end. We can locate that beginning in the second half of the 18th century. That's where I locate it, but historians can always find an earlier stage where something already, in my view, when the new individualism of the Enlightenment sort of discovered the market, and the market discovered modern technology, and this configuration began to become alive. Yeah, it began to drive each other. The individual interests being freed from traditional restrictions, and modern technology being instigated by economic interests and then reflecting back on the possibility of performing, of reaching economic goals. That sort of raises the issue, thirdly, of how we want to define capitalism if we locate a beginning. Now, there's some efforts being made in this book, and in order to briefly summarize this here, I would like to say the following. Capitalism is an unlikely social formation. It took and takes a lot of effort to institutionalize it and to make it work. Unlikely because what it is all about is the infinite accumulation of accumulating capital. Infinite accumulation, there's no end, it's always open-ended, through the infinite expansion of monetized transactions, sort of replacing non-monetized traditional transactions. So this thing moves into the life world, so to speak. It moves horizontally, because it begins in the center and then it sort of goes to the periphery and absorbs the periphery. And it moves vertically because in a capitalist society, more and more spheres of life are being discovered as potential sites for commodification, monetization, and so on. Only that which is monetized can be become part of the extraction of new capital, of capital accumulation. Capital is always money, but there are money economies that are not capitalist, but there is no capitalist economy without money. Yeah. So this expansion of the capitalist way of organizing social relations, Polanyi calls this catalactic transactions, goes together historically in the West with the replacing of a subsistence economy with a maximization economy. Now, in the chapter, famous chapter of primitive accumulation in Marx, you find this process described in great detail. The workers of the Middle Ages, if for some reason wages increased because there were fewer workers after the Black Death or whatever, then they worked only until Friday afternoon, and then they went home because then they had the amount of money that they needed in order to buy the drinks over the weekend. Yes, this sort of had to be completely changed in a mentality that makes needs dynamic rather than static, and therefore makes effort unending, infinite. You have to squeeze out of your personal capacities as much as you can get, rather than you stop where when you have what you think what you need. Yeah, And this re-education is the fundamental point in capitalism. If people don't work like that, Weber describes this basically in terms of the capitalist who keeps working and working and working, although the capital that he has accumulated would suffice for three or four lives for him, no problem. Yeah, but he keeps working and working. And you can also look at the worker, which Marx does, where he shows how the workers of the Middle Ages are being sort of re-educated in order to function like this, like maximizers, rather than satisfizers, you can say. But the tendency to satisfy and not maximize is something, I would argue, which is deeply human. So even in our societies, people have always to invent new tricks to make you work harder through consumption or whatever, through consumption norms, however you do it. Even yesterday, I think the New York Times had an article on Uber, this fancy thing, how they make their drivers work harder so that they do not go home and continue to work. And they use behavioral science technologies, which are exactly like what you can find in chapter 24 of the German edition, how you get people to work beyond their now defined needs. Yeah, we always are sort of tempted to stop where we think now we have what we want, but that would undermine the capitalist dynamic. So this complex of monetary arrangements, credit, cultural training, values by indoctrination now, or all sorts of techniques in the Middle Ages by sheer violence, as Marx describes it in this chapter. This sort of comes together to make possible this unlikely regime of the infinite accumulation of accumulating capital that is accumulated for the purpose of further accumulation. Yeah, all the major theorists of capitalism have tried to sort of capture this, especially Marx and Weber, which are hardly distinguishable on this point if you read them carefully. A system that is permanently restive replaces subsistence with maximization. Now, it is as a sort of proof that this is essentially an unlikely social formation, you can look at the theoretical attempts to understand this system, beginning from Mill to whoever. All of the major theorists of capitalism expected that during their lifetime, capitalism will come to an end. During their lifetime. And so John Stuart Mill, Karl Marx, Max Weber, Schumpeter, Sombart, Keynes. Keynes, this famous article on the economic prospects of our grandchildren, it still has this idea that no modern economist is willing to accept anymore of a definite limit of what you can consume. And since productivity would increase and increase, at some point we would all be forced to work no longer than 15 hours per week because what we would produce beyond these 15 hours, nobody could consume because it would be beyond the static needs that people have. So even Keynes couldn't anticipate this training that they permanently do on us so that we work harder and harder and harder. Yeah? So all of them thought that during their lifetime, for different reasons, that thing would not survive. In fact, Now you can say it's sort of not very risky to predict that capitalism will end during my lifetime, because then I will be in good company at least, and I don't have to be ashamed. But it is more you can draw more from this. One thing, my fifth point is that. The reason why these people thought that was that they observed one crisis after the other during their lifetime. Capitalism actually was always on the brink. in the late 19th century was a period of bankruptcies, banking crises, the tensions in the international system in the beginning of the 20th century had a lot to do with the governance of the spreading economic system of capitalism. The interwar years where the growth crisis of capitalism and the rivalries between four centers of political ambition, Soviet Union, Russia, Germany, and Japan, were deeply around the issue of how this unwieldy economic regime could come to some sort of stability. Yeah. So the only period where the beast was basically peaceful were the 30 years after 1945. And this was an exceptional period in the history of capitalism, really exceptional. And you can specify for what reason that happened, but after the 1970s, it sort of moved out. My metaphor is the predators that had been turned into milk cows sort of found it too boring to be stable fed, and they wanted to get out and become predators again, begin the hunt anew. And this is sort of the start of the neoliberal transformation of capitalism. One crisis after the other, before the post-war settlement. And if you read the classics, so to speak, and compare it to the historical developments, then one thing to me was so impressive that I thought that this is another reason why we could today think about this system coming to an end. And that is that the way it was rescued in these various crises was typically that it was rescued by its opposition. Keynes is the last representative of this. By introducing trade unions and social democratic welfare states, it protected capitalism from the problem from which it suffers now, that the dynamic inequality that is caused by market transactions, which function according to the Matthew principle, Matthew 19:25, something like this, he who has will be given, and he who does not have will be taken away, even what he has, says Jesus. Yeah. That results in a critical situation because the demand does not exist anymore for the rising productivity that comes with the organic composition of capitalism. Now, Keynes and trade unions and social democracy was the last invention to save capitalism from itself. My claim is that now that all these institutions have basically been cleared away by the neoliberal revolution in the era of globalization, now we lack these institutional mechanisms to bring back the capacity to redistribute from the top to the bottom in order to make the system viable again. And in the book I describe a development that I call the three and a half crises of capitalism after the 1970s, which begins with the inflation crisis in the 70s, the public debt crisis in the 1980s, the private debt crisis in the 1990s and early 2000s, and then the collapse of the private debt mechanism. All of these mechanisms were sort of inventions in order to keep the system going after the end of post-war growth and after the breakup of the post-war regime. Inflation was sort of necessary to accommodate strong trade unions in a world of declining growth in order to cause too much unemployment, which would have undermined the stability of the political system. But after a while, that solution turned into a problem itself. So 1980, the American Central Bank ended inflation once and forever. Then came public debt as a substitute for the pacifying effect of the inflation, especially in terms of the welfare state and the battles over welfare cuts or not. Public debt became a problem in the early in the mid 1990s, when under the leadership of the United States, sort of a huge international consolidation wave began, and you see that the United States achieved a balanced budget in the last year of Clinton. And the interesting thing that I had, incidentally, if I to insert this, the reason why I came back to a capitalism perspective rather than a comparative politics perspective was, if you looked at historical trajectories, as I began to do, rather than at a given situation, plus looked at the parallels between historical trajectories among OECD countries, what you observed was, first of all, that there was this stunning regularity. All of these economies had high inflation rates in the 1970s. All of them had increasing public debt in the 1980s. All of them went through consolidation, and then they opened up deregulated the financial system in order to substitute private debt for public debt. And then in 2008, when this era ended, the opposite movement took place. Now private debt was sort of deleveraged, but it was taken over by the states. And you get an enormous increase in public debt after 2008. And incidentally, I think the fourth period, which I think we're now in, and I wait what will happen next, was that the central banks were now buying up the debt. And so they became the owner and in many ways the creditor of last resort in these countries. And imagine, the European Central Bank now holds debt papers or bonds from private and from the private industry and from states to the tune of 30% of the aggregate gross domestic product of the Eurozone. And this increased from 5% after 2008. And the ascent is just like this. There's no end to be, no end to see. So again, you can see there's a stopgap, which we now call the rule of the central bank, but one that is limited in time. It cannot continue forever. And the central bank of the central banks, the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, every year they convene the heads of central banks from everywhere and tell them, you cannot continue this forever. And they say, we know. The Americans are trying to get out of quantitative easing for at least 5 years. Every year they announce it very carefully. And then they see, oh, my God, nobody knows what would happen. And so they continue. Yeah. Now she's trying it again, but the Europeans are heavily invested in quantitative easing now, and they will continue for a very long time. So what I'm saying is that if you look at the trajectory since the 1970s, the notion that this is a system out of control and that different tricks to keep it together are sort of following each other and are being tried out, and none of them sort of can continue. It's almost basically 10 years. Every 10 years something happens, and a new fix will have to be found. Now, on this context, I thought, let's think seriously about whether this thing is actually going to break, especially in the presence of the absence, or in the absence of the sort of healthy opposition that was able to correct and transform the system at so many stages in the history of capitalism. In order to think productively about this, another sort of decision has to be made. You have to discard what I call the Bolshevist theory of institutional change. The Bolshevist theory of institutional change is there is a central committee of the opposition that sort of after revolution goes to the radio stations and says, look, capitalism is over, now we replace it with X, yeah, communism or whatever. So that's the Bolshevist idea of change. Interestingly, it was realistic only at the end of communism. So that was exactly what happened in Moscow. Yeah, Yeltsin sort of convened the committee and he said, socialism is over, now we have capitalism. But that is impossible in capitalism for all sorts of reasons that have to do with the fact that now the beast is actually so much out of the cage that there is no government anymore in the world that can speak on behalf of and about capitalism as a whole. It is sort of gone out of control. And so my the idea that I pursue in the book is to try to think about a developed society, a developed global society, without the capacity to govern itself, that has lost the ability to develop even alternatives to a regime that in itself is failing. Yeah, the sort of intellectual matrix for this is found in Antonio Gramsci's notion of the interregnum, the period which he calls where the old order is dying, but a new order cannot yet be born. Yeah, and he says that in an interregnum, all sorts of monstrous things can happen any day. And so if I think of the election in the United States last year, that comes pretty close. Yeah, that comes pretty close. And I think the interesting question is to explore what a world without some sort of institutionalized order is going to be like, where the state system as the center of governance of the capitalist economy is disabled. Now, I will conclude by saying a few things on what I think gets us closer to the European problems, and that is what I call the crisis of the international state system as a result of the globalization of capitalism. Yeah? Historically, states had two functions in the development of capitalism. One is you needed a hegemon that acted as the enforcer and the banker of last resort. This was usually a military power, which was also a big monetary power at the same time. It was only with the presence of this sort of hegemonic control over the global capitalist system that the system could begin to grow at its borders, that it could absorb its periphery, as it has to in order to grow. Yeah. Historically, you can, with Arrighi, sort of reconstruct a development from the first hegemon, which was probably Genova, to the second one, almost forgotten, but the center of capitalist innovation in the 18th century was the Netherlands, Amsterdam, the first central bank and sort of very fancy inventions in terms of monetary policy. Then it moves after the war, and wars are important in this segment. After the war between the Netherlands and England, it moves to London. Yeah? And sort of the British Empire, with London at the center, becomes the you can say the carrier nation of capitalism. Then begins the Great Disorder after the First World War. After the First World War, the Japanese and the Germans had lost any confidence that the hegemon would respect their interests. Yeah. And in fact, the hegemon was tired. The British were no longer able to do it. The Americans refused to do it. They didn't feel up to the task. until John Maynard Keynes explained to Roosevelt that they had to do it. But that was 20 years off. Now then, you see a situation where control over the capitalist expansion process and the capitalist global economy is split between an unwilling hegemon and a future hegemon who is not yet, or a disabled one and an unwilling one, and then two centers of an alternative organization of the capitalist economy, namely autarky. Both the Japanese and the Germans at the time, having lost any confidence in the global system, began to become autarkic, which, however, implied unpleasantly that they had to conquer the countries where they wanted to sell their product, and they had to and where they wanted to get their raw materials from. So they became expansionary, but in military terms, in order to draw a border around their. So after they lost the war, the historical opportunity existed that now the United States could be the hegemon on a global scale. The Russians were sort of out of the game. But the Germans and the Japanese were gone. And so you had 30 years of peace and 30 years of peaceful capitalist development. This thing, as I said, ended in the 1970s. Now, slowly, with the Americans losing the wars that they begin, for strange reasons sometimes, you don't understand why they do this, the Americans are losing respect, the Chinese are rising on the horizon, the question becomes, sort of, can two hegemons work together to govern that regime? Has never happened before. In fact, it was always fought out militarily who was going to be the governor of the global capitalist system. Good question for international relations scholars. Is it possible that the Chinese and the Americans sort of work together and stabilize the economy? I tell you, there's two different things that are very important. One is the exchange rates between their currencies, one of the critical problems of international political economy. The other is debt. Will the Chinese continue to buy the American debt, or will they sell it? So these things become extremely unstable. My claim is the international political economy, as a result of this, is going to be extremely unstable. What happens at the national level? Now, nationally, the role of the state was to ensure that the penetration, the sort of vertical penetration of society by the capitalist expansion process was actually legitimate, could happen, was tolerated, at least accepted. Yeah. Now that is today, as you look around and see the reactions of electorates to globalization, namely in almost all of the European countries, like in the United States, where globalization sort of has proceeded very fast, you see that those that are that have lost in the process begin to remember their national state. The national state that had, they had been told that there's no national politics anymore. There is no alternative. Tina. Yeah? There is no alternative. We have to open up, we have to liberalize, you have to struggle, you have to fight. In the end, you'll do better. What happened was they didn't do better. There's large chunks of the population that both culturally as well as economically suffer from this process. Yeah? And these people now sort of begin in a very surprising way. When I wrote some of the chapters here, I did not anticipate that the reaction would be so strong. In a matter of 2 or 3 years, what happened in all of these countries, including the United States, is the destruction of the center-left moderates who promised to the former working class or to the working class that they would somehow moderate the process. So In the Netherlands, the Partij van de Arbeid, which in the 1990s was a model of reasonable social democracy, being both representative of the vast majority of the Dutch working class and attentive to the problems, social policy, employment problems that came from the opening up of the economy, it is now reduced to 5% of the vote. It's basically gone. And this guy Wilders, who is 25%, absorbs basically the electorate, the part of the electorate that used to vote for. Look at the United States, where Trump destroyed the Clinton machine. Clinton, to me, is the sort of equivalent of the center-left version, yeah? Where, basically the difference between center-left and center-right, which is one of the problems of governance at the national level, has disappeared in the period of globalization. In America, one could have thought before the election that the old Republican families and the sort of rich Republican constituents, that they could have tolerated a victory of Hillary, and they would have preferred it to Trump. Yeah, but of course, it didn't work out. Yeah, it didn't work out. So you look around and you see that at the national level, there's also a crisis of the state system, and it looks conspicuously similar from state to state. Brexit fits into the picture. Let me conclude by saying that this problem, as a political economic problem, can also be phrased in the following way. It is a problem of the scale, the optimal or desirable scale of government in today's globalized economy. Denmark, yeah? Is it good to be small and have your own currency? Yes, Denmark is an example. Is it good to be small and have a European currency? No, Finland is an awful example for this. Yeah? Is it good to be big? Yes, it is good to be big if you're China. Yeah? Is it good for Italy to be part of a big unit which is called Euroland? For God's sake, no. The country is going down the drain every year more and more. And the political system has completely dissolved. The Partito Democratico is almost completely gone. And sort of a television comedian is the important political figure in the country. Yeah? And so the question is, where is this beast to be governed? Be small and then sort of make intelligent choices like the Danes did. We do consulting and logistics and these things and education. Or is it good to not to put your eggs in all your eggs in one basket? And then you have a diversified economy. Then you have to be bigger. How much sovereignty do you need in order to survive in this? The German idea is the Italians don't need any sovereignty because we have it for them, and never let the Greeks shouldn't be given sovereignty in the first place because they cannot use it. Yeah. The Americans don't believe in national sovereignty except for their own country. Yeah. And so you get a big, big mess on the very fundamental problem: where is the optimal size of government in a world in which capitalism is global, but politics is local or regional or national, and nobody knows how to do this. This is my description of the interregnum. I end with a metaphor. In a recent article, I described the interregnum as a time in which the dead body of capitalism is still lying around, but nobody has the power to push it out of the way so that there is a new future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Streck. So if we sober up and we realize that just like in the case of environmental destruction, we are past the point when things could be reformed, if the decaying body is down on the ground, two issues come out. The first is that this putrefaction can take several generations.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very, very long. It is no longer terminal, it is death, yes? So that's a very long period of time for most of us in the room. So do you have any advice how to make this interregnum more bearable for those who sober up and have no illusions? So in a way, if we move from forgiveness and reconciliation to a sort of Calvinist predestination, how do we survive that material and theological condition?
I've become intrigued with the question of transitions and long-term intermissions in historical development. The most important model in Europe is, of course, the end of the Western Roman Empire. Yeah, from 480 on, there was no emperor anymore. And the thing sort of begins to disintegrate. Nobody at this point knew that the new model of society would be called feudalism. In fact, nobody knew what feudalism is because it took 400 years to figure out what it was. Yeah, and then maybe a little more than 400 years, someone for the first time could say, "Oh God, we have feudalism." Yeah, and so I think it doesn't have to be like this. But then the interesting question is, what did people do in the meantime? Now, this was a period of great uncertainty. There could always be some sort of Germans come out of the bush and steal your children or women or whatever. But most people essentially survived by improvising. Yeah, the closest image that I have of the world in the next 20, 30 years is one of great uncertainty, unpredictable events happening all the time. Look like the climate change. And the climate change prediction is not it's going to be hotter. It is you get unusual weather everywhere. That's the central prediction. And I think for politics, it's exactly the same. The old lines of causation are no longer valid and we can't predict anymore. So improvisation, the burden of organizing your everyday life will fall on individuals in a way that we, and also the possibility to have bad luck, it will fall on individuals and there will be no institutional remedy. My worst future scenario in the interregnum is the impact of artificial intelligence on the professional structure and on the labor market. We now have no trade unions that could regulate it. We have no social democratic government that could regulate this. And maybe everybody today who's driving cars or trucks or tanks or whatever they drive will be out of business in 10 years. Imagine. Yeah, and maybe even lawyers will be out of business.
Thank you. That leads me to my second question.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is if we don't sober up and if we do a little bit of comparative historical analysis and we look at a period in Western capitalist history when things were much worse from the point of view of the variables you mentioned, except the consumption and re-education part. I'm thinking here of the period that Hobsbawm describes in the 1860s, right? Mm-hmm. When labor contract lasted a week, mm-hmm. when there was a gold standard with automatic adjustments, mm-hmm. No, there was no taxation, repression was horrific, mm-hmm. No gloves there. So an interregnum came after the 1873 crisis that was pregnant with more progressive and mm-hmm. humane possibilities. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't those possibilities not reemerge? Or better, mm-hmm. The better question is, under what circumstances mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can those possibilities materialize mm-hmm. in a way that would make the interregnum bearable?
Yeah, that is that would almost be the question of the new order after the interregnum. But I don't want to insist on this distinction. My we all have different, and I mean in periods in which such uncertainty sort of begins to reign, it's basically free for everyone to have his or her preferred vision of the future. Because you can't really say much about probabilities. If you ask me personally, and it may sort of have filtered into my analysis of the problem, then I think I would begin with the with a very fundamental point that I think is incontestable, which is that the way of life that we are living in the United States and in Europe is not generalizable. It's not generalizable. So from this, I would conclude that capitalism, with its internal growth dynamic, is no longer possible, because the subsumption of the entire world under this maximization machine is self-destructive. Yeah. So I think culturally and in terms of the economy, we would have to learn to be more modest, to not insist on being always the best and having the latest car and all of this. It's a very, very mushy description, I think, which I basically don't like. But which you, while you asked me, I think a modern subsistence economy would have to be at the end of the interregnum, at a higher level of technology. In many ways, what Keynes describes for the prospects of the grandchildren, only that he assumes that a subsistence economy is easy to be institutionalized because people are waiting for it. I think people will have to suffer before they learn that subsistence is the only way of living in a finite world. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Dr. Streck.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Wolfgang Streck, Director Emeritus at the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Societies in Cologne. Tonight's lecture was titled, How Will Capitalism End? Reflections on a Failing System, and was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Tonight's moderator was Cornell Bann, Assistant Professor of International Relations and Co-Director of the Global Economic Governance Initiative at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, WBUR.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Ian McCarn and Edward T. Mazulis. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.